Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Martin Oliphant had always hated horses. Their staggering stupidity, their unexplained, unexpected, and ever-explosive snorting, the way they twitched distinct patches of their skin to dislodge flies, the way they shied madly at the most innocuous occurrences, a golf umbrella at 50 feet, a leaf falling from, of all places, a tree, a bale of hay stacked exactly where it was supposed to be, stacked, and had been stacked for the last month. Martin Oliphant hated horses, but he didn't, it must be said, wish horses dead. It must be said because horses died around him, died or almost died. And it was horses, dead ones mostly, that blazed the trail to his life-forging passion. Horses brought Martin to cowboy poetry. And horses, live ones mostly, were cowboy poetry's central theme. This is G.P. Gottlieb, and today I'm talking to author K.T. Sparks about her debut novel, Four Dead Horses. It's the story of Martin Oliphant, who becomes enamored of cowboy poetry as a teen growing up in Pierre, Michigan, and strives for 30 years to make his way to the annual Elko Cowboy Poetry Confluence. His life doesn't turn out the way he thought, and it takes the death of a world-famous horse in his hometown some 30 years later to propel Martin to the place he dreamt of so long before. Hi, KT. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. It's great to be here. I love talking to readers almost as much as I love reading.
Your debut novel is one of the most unusual coming-of-age big journey novels I've ever read. How did you come up with this story?
It was a collection of a lot of things. You know, a lot of authors, I think, have something they want to write about or a big theme. I'm one of those people who I get a scene or something that happens to me, just a little thing stuck in my head. And that's what happened with this novel, very much so. I was at a dude ranch that my family has gone to for the last 25 years down in Southern Colorado. And I wasn't able to ride because I had broken my knee. And I was sitting, and a guy, usually guests stay there for a week, but this guy was visiting, and I think with his older parents, he was in his 50s, I would say. And they were just coming by, I think, just to look at the place. And I watched him looking out over, you can watch the riders go out from the big lodge. So he's looking out, watching these riders go out. And he's kind of dressed in like a short sleeve polyester shirt that was screaming for a clip on tie and a pair of like Dockers and just inappropriate shoes. He looked as little as, you know, like a Westerner or a cowboy as possible. And he had this look, and he was overweight. He looked like he'd never been on or near a horse. And he had a look on his face like, you know, like he was seeing himself down there, and he was seeing himself in a cowboy hat and riding off into the sunset. I imagined he was like, you know, sort of had some horrible, awful office job in Topeka or Cleveland, and nothing wrong with Topeka and Cleveland, but that's where he was. But he was imagining himself in that moment as a real cowboy, and he was really there. And that became my main character. And he actually first inhabited a short story, that was, published several years ago, and he was kind of, it was not really much of the same stuff, but the same guy. And you know, from there I just started writing.
So it's rare to meet a Michigan bred protagonist with a 60-inch waist who dreams of reciting cowboy poetry. So that was the birth of Martin Oliphant, right? So
right.
Can you say more about him?
He is a guy. He grows up the same time I grew up in the small town, which is across the lake, basically across Lake Michigan from Chicago, where I grew up, though I renamed it. And he's a guy who has big dreams. He has dreams that he feels are much bigger than his small town. He's kind of an intellectual. He's going to end up going to the University of Chicago, out of this little town. He's ready to, you know, to move into those dreams. And he's almost like a Walter Mitty type of character who he imagines himself sort of rising above his existence in a town where, you know, I think he just doesn't fit in any way. And he spends a lot of his life sort of imagining himself moving on to some greater things, or the greater things that he thinks he's really ready for, but in a sort of kind and gentle way. I mean, he's not a jerk. He's kind of a dreamer, and he's kind of a sad sack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's discuss your title. How did you decide on Four Dead Horses as opposed to Cowboy Wannabes or Return to Elko?
You know, the initial title was Road to Elko. And which sort of sounds like a song. And one of my very good friends, who's also been a mentor and has helped a ton on this novel, CJ Hauser, she wrote, One of my friends, who was a mentor of mine, helped me come up with this title. Its initial title was Road to Elko. And this person, CJ Hauser, she's a wonderful author in her own right. She wrote a viral essay a couple of years ago called The Crane Wife. And she's about to come out with a book of essays by the same name. She was reading it one time, and she was reading through, and she said, you know, Kate, the sort of cost in equine lives in this book of Martin's journey seems to be adding up. She said, I've counted, you know, four horses that have died by the end of this. And she said, you know, why don't you use that as an organizing principle for the book? Because before it had been organized a lot like it is now, which is sort of a Martin in his teen years and then Martin in his later years. I hadn't quite sort of thought of the fact that there were in fact horses dying regularly throughout the book. And I said, I kind of love it, but I said, you know, I'm, will people read a book called Four Dead Horses? And she said, you know, a lot of people will pick up a book called Four Dead Horses and say, this is not something I want to read. She said, but the people who will like your book will look at it and say, this is something I want to read. So I think Road to Elko sounds to me a little bit like, I liked it, but it sounds a little like a country song or something. And not, it doesn't have the kind of black humor that I think the book has.
Yeah, that black humor, that is true. What intrigued you about cowboy poetry?
Nothing initially, because when I wrote the first short story about Martin, he was at a dude ranch, and he was sort of in he was very jealous of the dude ranch's resident cowboy poet. And I thought I made it up. You know, I thought, like, I didn't think there were such things as cowboy poets. I thought I had made up this sort of funny thing that the dude ranch would hire a guy who would be paid to be a cowboy poet. And I later, after the story, I mean, literally after the story was done, and I was workshopping it, somebody said, you know, this is a great character, and you should, you know, this guy who is jealous of a cowboy poet, you know, but he's from the Midwest and he's just as little cowboy as possible. You know, you should write more about it. And I started looking into it and discovered that there's this huge world of cowboy poetry. And I'm really embarrassed to say this because I have fallen in love with the world. And it's a sort of performative folk art that is, you know, the NEA recognizes it. There are some, maybe one very famous sort of national, Baxter Black, who's a national cowboy poet, who people might have heard of, but it's a really rich folk art culture that goes on. It's sort of based around Elko, Nevada, but in all the ranching communities. And it's something that has a history that goes back to before, sort of right after the Civil War is when it got started, and then had a big heyday at the turn of the century, and then sort of disappeared once the singing cowboys came along, the Roy Rogers of the world, until the 80s when a group of ethnographers and sort of professors, they started finding a few of these guys who were still writing, and they pulled together the first what's called the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, which is what the Confluence, the National Cowboy Poetry Confluence that Martin is so obsessed with, is based on. It's an actual thing. It's happened every year since 1985. And the very first one, there were all these guys who were writing cowboy poetry, but they weren't talking. They didn't know that other people were doing it. And it's an incredible art form. So I've come to love it. When I did it initially, part of it was I thought I was making up something funny. And the other part was I really am not a big fan of research. So I thought, like, how if I make this up, I don't actually have to research it. I can just make up what cowboy poetry is. Turns out it has a rich history. Wow. And I've become kind of an expert on it for outside the cowboy world. And gladly so, even though research isn't usually the thing I want to do. I'd rather make stuff up.
Yeah. I get that. So you mentioned obsession. That's another ongoing theme, obsession. There's a lot of it. Martin's family, his father is obsessed with destroying people's businesses, and his mother is obsessed with one of the neighbors, and Martin is obsessed with cowboy poetry. Can we talk about the parents?
Sure. They're very 1970s parents in some ways, really not paying a lot of attention. They're sort of small climbers, and they are not, I want to say very clearly, because as I said, the book is based on my hometown. They are not based on anyone in my hometown. they're more of both of them are people. I mean, the dad is just sort of very singularly focused on business and making money. And the mom is very singularly focused on status, gaining status in her social world. And I think, you know, I think for they basically left Martin alone. He doesn't really help them. He doesn't really hurt them. They're not mean to him, but they kind of pursue their own lives. And there was a thing about 70s parenting, and it's so different. I know you're a mom and so am I. And it was just a different time growing up then. And parents were really sort of, kids were kind of a little bit feral. They were sort of raising themselves. And I think that's the main thing with his parents. I think Martin loves his parents, and I think that they love him in as much as sort of small-minded people of that era would love kids. They fed him. They made sure he got to school on time and everything else. But they weren't really involved in his life, and they didn't. They just went off and sort of did their own things.
Well, they didn't really understand him, but they did understand the brother, Frank, because he's a tennis guy, and that
right.
They had all kinds of accolades and all kinds of time for that.
And that was kind of a currency, you know, sort of being good at sports and being good, especially at tennis, which was so big at that period. And it was so big among, at least in the town I was growing up, it was very big among the sort of elite in the town. You know, so he sort of brought something to the table. And Martin, you know, they weren't embarrassed by him. They just weren't sort of cognizant of him. He didn't really help or hurt anything. And he sort of bought into that too. He was just going to leave, you know, he was going to go to the University of Chicago. And he has, in the beginning, there's a couple times where he thinks about like, well, maybe his dad will call on him to, you know, sort of be part of the business. And he'll impress him because he's going to the University of Chicago and there's so many wonderful economists there. And he's going to, you know, he sort of, his Walter Mitty, like imaginings, even before he's introduced to cowboy poetry are already drive him to sort of those kind of thoughts, but he's, you know, he's quickly shot down on that kind of stuff. And he seems to be the kind of guy who's very used to being quickly shot down in that. And he just, you know, it moves on. He moved on and he had his sights someplace else. He was going away. He was going to go to a different world.
Mm-hmm. Just to confirm, KT, there's no actual Bitsy Newport in your hometown who is the grand dame of the tennis club and everybody wants to be like her.
There's absolutely nobody like that. And there's my parents actually were in a, you know, I was like, yes, thank you for that because I know I have lots of friends left there and they'll read the book and, you know, it's, I want to make sure that people know that. I mean, there definitely was a tennis culture when I was growing up. I played tennis on the University of Chicago tennis team too, which is exactly, you know, people say no small feat. It's actually a very small feat. Basically, you had to own a racket. But you know, there was a tennis, you know, there were country clubs where their tennis was played, and there was my parents belonged to a tennis group, which was, you know, the nicest people, and they, you know, they played all the time. I think what I did is I just turned that into a sort of a darker version of what that could have been if it weren't, if it hadn't been made up of really some of the kindest and really fun people that I'd ever met. So it's you know, it is definitely not anybody real. In fact, it's funny because a long time ago I was at a workshop where people were talking about you know, about writers and should you copy people, and I always remember Pam Houston, the writer, was leading the workshop, and she said, you know, I wouldn't, she said, because even writers need to go someplace for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. But let's say Julie Newport, Bitsy's daughter, there's a lot of distinction. Are you telling me that there's nobody in your entire town who ever, you know, was the star athlete and then gained weight? Uh-oh.
No, I mean, I'm sure that did happen somewhere along the way, but certainly nobody I knew.
Okay.
Yeah, no, there was no, it's definitely not, but that's not based on anybody. That's, you know, that's, Julie's a complicated character. I mean, she's somebody who, I guess complicated isn't the right word. She's just somebody, every kid who has been sort of actively harmed by both food culture, but also by, you know, by a mom who is more than neglectful, like Martin's mom, but you sort of outright dangerous to her daughter. And that's just something I've seen, you know, not real people, but I've seen it in a lot of places, not just at that time and place.
I thought you handled that really sensitively. It was very clear, but you never came right out and said it. It was very clear that Bitsy was just the worst possible, handling Julie's issues in the worst possible way. But she pulled herself together. Julie became her own person.
She did. And I wanted that to happen. You know, the other thing that I wondered about putting it in the book, but Julie doesn't reject her mom either, which is sort of interesting and a little sad. I mean, I didn't want it all to be like object lessons, you know, sort of.
She's also a hero, I thought, because the way she handles Martin's mother, who is dying of cancer, is just really beautiful.
Yeah. And she finds this strength and this compassion in herself, you know, that I think makes her strong for a really long time. And I think makes her into an interesting character. And also, you know, she was sort of what Martin, just in very general, she was what Martin wanted to be, what maybe Martin's mother wanted her to be when she was younger, before she gained weight, when she was the star athlete, you know, and it didn't work out for her, and her, you know, those early dreams that were sort of to be this like her mother, the kind of queen of this very small town, were wrecked when she gained weight and her mother sort of rejected her. But she, you know, she's a person who sort of pursued dreams more realistically. I kind of almost, you know, I've lately been thinking it's interesting the different way that Julie and Martin go about pursuing dreams. You know, mm-hmm. Julie's just much more practical. It's kind of, I kind of feel like Martin as a male is allowed to have bigger dreams and more impractical dreams than Julie, you know, was.
Yeah, you could be right. Martin's younger brother, Frank, doesn't at all seem like he's bound for any kind of success. What's up with him?
He's just kind of adult. I mean, he's the guy we all know who, you know, who gets a lot of stuff because his dad either has money or, you know, he's been told his whole life he's going to be fine and great, and he sort of walks into everything. I mean, he might just be, you know, white male privilege embodied. He has zero recognition, and you know, as life often works, he's not punished. He gets stuff, and he has the house and the beautiful wife, and he doesn't think much about it. And so in a way too, I kind of like, you know, looking at him and say, here's a guy who I guess realized his dreams in air quotes. But at the same time, like, was that so great? I mean, is he happier than Martin, who struggles with his own wild dreams? But, you know, is Frank really that great a life, even though he's got, you know, he has everything and nothing bad happens to him?
Yeah. Cancer plays a role. Can you say more about that?
I had breast cancer in 2008 and some pretty grueling treatment. And I'm fine now, which is great. But, you know, I started writing this book, you know, a few years after that diagnosis. And it was on my mind, you know, it was just on my mind as something that that is another way that dreams get derailed. And so I was thinking, and that's a lot with Julie. She talks at one point about how hard it is to sort of, even when you're well, even after you've gone through treatment and you've been sort of sent off, how hard it is to sort of stop thinking about having cancer and start thinking about dreams and life and everything else. I think I was probably feeling a lot that way at that time. So it's, you know, it's a terrible disease. I also watched a friend die and a family member die during that same period. And I think Martin's mom, you know, I wanted Martin to, you know, Martin stays home for a very long time and takes care of his mom while she's dying of breast cancer. And, you know, I wanted that. I wanted, I wanted it to be a big thing that Martin was doing, and a big thing that Julie was doing, because she helps too.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind at that point, cancer was just looming large, and it was the big thing that they always say, you know, write about. But it makes it sound a little bit like the book is a sad cancer book, which it's not.
No, you managed somehow to make it funny. And as a fellow breast cancer survivor, I'm pretty sensitive to it, but you made it funny. So kudos for that.
I know it's awful, but as you know, I mean, it's very life-changing. It's very scary. It affects everybody around you. And at the same time, you know, life with all of its weird absurdities keeps plowing along. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to capture a little bit of that too, I think.
You got it. I think you got it. How much fun did you have creating this novel?
It just depends on what day you got me. Some days I hated it because it went through a lot of drafts. And you're a writer, you know how that goes. I mean, it sort of became a lot of different things, and different people were a lot in it and not. Like, Julie has a much bigger role than she had initially. And that was from feedback from a lot of people, especially women, who said, like, you know, Julie is an interesting character. Martin is funny, and he certainly is, you know, he's unique in his whole quest, but Julie is real, and we want to see more of her. And so she showed up a lot more in later drafts. But the funnest thing I got to do was go to the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering and meet a bunch of these poets, cowboy poets.
Wow.
That Martin loves so much, and watch them perform. And I totally recommend it. Elko, Nevada, end of January, a lovely time to be in the High Sierra. You know, it's in the middle of nowhere. And these guys are great. They're fantastic performers. They are performing poetry, you know, sort of out full regalia out loud to other cowboys, also completely decked out. They're doing it for each other. They're not doing it for anything but the love of poetry, which, and the love of the sort of performance aspect of it, because they are performers. And some of the poetry is really good, but the performances are just great. And you walk out of there and you're like, I want to be a cowboy poet. I want to be with Martin and, you know, recite in front of these guys. It's really a fun event.
Well, KT, I'd be more likely to join you at Santa Fe for the opera festival, but it does sound interesting. So tell me, what are you working on next?
I've started another novel. Obsessions are kind of my thing. And this is another novel that is so formless right now that it's a little bit hard to describe. But it is, again, based on just sort of an event. And there was in 1983, there was, I'm a lifelong Chicago Cubs fan until the Nationals, Washington Nationals, appeared on the scene. But I was at this game in 1983, a Cubs game, and it's called the Ryan Sandberg game. And it's famous among Cubs fans because
I'm well aware of that game.
Okay, great.
I'm not a Cubs fan. I'm sorry to say I'm a White Sox fan, but go ahead.
Well, and we may have to just end the conversation there. But I was at the Ryan Sandberg game, and it suddenly occurred to me, like, what if I sort of said another, what if I did a story where it's all around a murder that you know happens, or actually an arrest for a murder that happens at the Ryan Sandberg game, something that happens at that game, and it all sort of comes to a head at that game. And it's probably going to be based again in the town of Pierre, though I don't know if I'll call it Pierre again. Leading up to that game, it's probably going to involve a mother figure who is obsessed with baseball, and a daughter figure who's young at that point, but gets sort of involved with, it'll be a sort of type of a cult that actually does exist in my town, and it has for many years, the House of David. You've probably heard of it.
No, but wow.
Yeah, there's St. Joe, Michigan has its own little cult. I'm not sure, there's not very much left of them anymore, but then I'm going to try to tell the story, you know, sort of back almost a little bit like Four Dead Horses is structured back then and now, but also from different perspectives. I want to do it as a sort of first person from the young girl who ends up at the Ryan Sandberg game, where her family is sort of put in turmoil because of a murder. And then in the future, I want to have sort of telling it at the same time, the future story where she and her daughter, who's a podcaster, look back into what happened on that day. And then I also want to include the podcast that the daughter makes, sort of like a serial type podcast about her own family. So it's just a sort of, yeah, I know, right?
You got a lot of work on your plate. You got a lot to do. Get to work. Wow. It sounds wonderful. Keep me posted. I'm interested. And thank you so much, KT, for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for the opportunity. This has really been fun.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with author K.T. Sparks about her debut novel, Four Dead Horses. Hope you're all able to lose yourself in a good book today and tomorrow, too. Happy reading.